there's this sudden new interest in faith. Completely unexpected, because everyone assumed young people, especially young men, who are the demographic that seems most likely to be re-engaging with faith, everyone assumed they were gone forever from the pews of church. And yet,
there's this really paradoxical quality of the internet, and it really is a two-edged sword. I think it's making things worse, and it's also making things more religious again.
Yes,
what do you think?
I entirely agree. This incredibly materialistic, tech-driven culture that tends to exacerbate all our worst aspects as humans, that you suddenly get this crunch point that I think we've hit. There's pure motives and very mixed motives when it comes to why people want to see Christianity back. My sense is, I speak here as a Christian, is there is a God, and the gates of hell will not prevail over the church. But what that looks like in the messy tangle of human history, we will probably only really be able to tell.
Hello and welcome to Socrates in the City. I'm Mary Harrington, an author and journalist, and it's a privilege to be joined today by Justin Brierley, an author, a podcaster, and a writer, and somebody who has been hugely interesting to me as a documenter for a number of years of the surprising rebirth of belief in God. Justin has been the host of a number of podcasts over the years, debating with people who are not believers, or people who might be believers, or people who feel uncertain about their faith. Justin has noticed something changing. Now, my first encounter with the phenomenon that you document in such meticulous and interesting detail was actually from a balcony at an ideas event last year in New York City, and where I watched Richard Dawkins, who I know you've debated with on occasions, discussing on stage with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who's an old new atheist friend of his, her surprising conversion to Christianity. And I stared at this thinking, this is not something which would have happened. This is not something I ever could have imagined happening 20 years ago. Now, when I was at university, which is years ago, it just wasn't cool to be a Christian. And now here we are. So something is changing. Something has changed. Tell me how you came to notice this, and tell me...
Well, it really goes back to the heyday of the New Atheist movement. So this was the sort of mid-2000s. And you may remember, Mary, casting your mind back to then, that there was the best-selling anti-God books by Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett. And there was even, you know, things like the Atheist Bus Campaign in London, you know, red London buses bearing the slogan, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." And it was sort of this interesting moment when atheism became very cool. You know, lots of headlines, you know, TV shows, big conferences, you know. And there were a number of factors going into that. It was sort of coming on the heels of 9/11, and there were worries about, you know, creationism being taught in schools in the US. All sorts of things were sort of feeding into this. And obviously the birth of the internet essentially kind of allowed a kind of movement like this to flourish online of skeptics and atheists sort of taking a pop at religion and so on. And I started in that time to start hosting conversations, essentially.
So there was something different about the New Atheists compared to what you saw, Common or Garden atheism up to that point?
I think so. I mean, obviously, atheism has been around a long time, and you had, you know, in the early 20th century, people like Bertrand Russell and others who were sort of professional atheists, if you will, sometimes having, you know, debates with, you know, people like Copleston on the BBC about God and science and so on. But I think what the difference was, it tended to be located more in the academy still in that era, and didn't tend to filter down to the popular culture. Whereas the New Atheism was very much a popular level version of atheism. It was all about the memes and the online community and everything else. And so it felt a lot more in your face. And it also felt just a bit more dogmatic, even aggressive at times, very much sort of poo-pooing and dismissing religion, making fun of it, you know. And so you had sort of comedians like Ricky Gervais and Bill Maher and others sort of creating sort of sketches and documentaries kind of trashing religion and so on. So it felt like there was this energy behind this sort of quite anti-theistic kind of stuff. And I just found all that interesting. I began hosting conversations at that point on a show called Unbelievable, which was first a radio show, then a podcast, and bringing Christians and non-Christians together. And as much as, you know, the New Atheism itself was arguably a bit of a a shallow and sort of fundamentalist in itself sort of version of non-belief.
Ironically so.
Yes. It was still a really interesting moment to start having these conversations because it did provide a really interesting set of talking points with these high-profile figures like Dawkins and Hitchens making these very, you know, bold statements against faith. And so I began this show. We started having these conversations. And in the process, I realized actually there's actually some quite good answers to the atheist objections. There are reasons why it might make sense to believe in Christianity, the history of it, the philosophical justifications for it, and so on. And I ended up hosting that show for, well, nearly 20 years. But what was interesting was that in the process of those 2 decades, I did notice this very significant shift from this very bombastic new atheist moment, which waned almost as quickly as it had sprung up, to a something very different coming in its place in the latter part of those 2 decades. And so by the time I finished hosting that show, I wasn't really featuring that many of these sort of new atheist types, because to some extent the movement itself had sort of imploded. It had you know, gone off with, you know, great hopes and a lot of sort of optimism in the idea that science and faith will bring us into some sort of utopia. But then once they had agreed God doesn't exist and religion's bad for you, it turned out the architects of new atheism really couldn't agree on anything else.
Well, it's difficult to form any kind of a coherent body of anything on the basis of negation, isn't it?
Exactly, that's it. You can't really build a positive movement.
More or less by definition.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing where you can, you know, tearing down God is, you know, relatively easy, but what do you put in God's place? Because people still need something to kind of base their lives around.
I remember, I think possibly my first encounter with new atheism in any sort of direct way was when they started to fight internally about wokeness.
Absolutely. And wokeness kind of came early for that movement.
That's right. That's right. Can you say, I mean, and that's a really interesting internal conflict. And my sense is that that's been a challenge, particularly for Richard Dawkins, who's a scientist and obviously a very sincere truth seeker.
Absolutely.
A man who really is committed to the truth to the best of his understanding of it, and who's been confronted by some of his what he thought were fellow travellers, who are committed to, for example, the ideology that men can be women, which from a scientific point of view just sort of doesn't really work.
I mean, The moment that I think we started to see this tipping in the new atheist movement was a moment that came to be dubbed Elevator Gate. And this was in 2012. And there had been a gathering of atheists at a sort of atheist conference in Dublin. Richard Dawkins was among the contributors. And one of the other people leading a session was a young skeptic called Rebecca Watson. And she had a sort of video channel and so on. But which particularly was starting to focus on the problems in the atheist community, she saw it, of misogyny and patriarchy and sexism and so on. And so she'd just done a sort of session talking about this. And that evening, sort of late into the night, they had drinks together, all the speakers and so on. She went to go back to her hotel room, and one of the other delegates at the conference sort of was in the elevator and basically propositioned her, you know, do you want to come back to my room for a coffee sort of thing? And she went on to sort of vlog about this afterwards, saying, look, everyone, this is the problem. I'd literally just done this thing on why women feel uncomfortable in the atheist movement, and here's someone propositioning me. Now, that might have been the end of it, except that Richard Dawkins then did a very highly sarcastic response to this, sort of in the voice of a sort of Muslim woman, you know, from Saudi Arabia, saying, don't pity me in the fact that I might have my hands chopped off if I go against my religious beliefs. Pity my poor American sisters who are being asked for a coffee in an elevator. You know, it was highly sarcastic. Anyway, this just poured, you know, gasoline on the whole thing. The whole thing sort of exploded with people who were on Dawkins' side, let's just be commonsensical about this, people who were on Watson's side, you know.
I think I remember
that. Yeah, so this was sort of, you know, and obviously these things tend to be contained within these communities, but it was a big deal within the new atheist movement.
No, this one escaped containment, because this was not a movement I was tracking at the time.
So Elevator Gate sort of, I think, was this defining moment when suddenly some people in this atheist movement said, well, actually, no, we should be on the side of social justice and feminism and LGBT rights and so on. Whereas Dawkins and others were like, oh, no, that's all politically correct stuff. Let's just focus on science and reason and so on.
But this is a real challenge for a if you're going to dispense with God, then it's very difficult to see what you're using to ground a moral framework.
Absolutely.
And then when you realise that you do actually want a moral framework, for example, because you don't want to be for whatever reason, perhaps you don't like being propositioned in elevators or you think that that's a problem for whatever reason. But if when you need a moral framework and you're surrounded by people whose only yardstick for the good is skepticism and a desire to challenge or critique everything, then it's sort of
absolutely
and then all you have left is shouting, which I suppose is
that's it
happens.
And there was a lot of shouting, and so a number of these issues started to come out, and essentially lots of these quite well-known atheists started to take positions on either side, and people who had once been happy to share stages together at these atheist conferences started falling out with each other. The whole movement kind of unraveled internally at this point. And as you say, Dawkins himself became something of a lightning rod for controversy increasingly, because he was standing up against sort of transgender ideology and so on. And, leading to him in, I think it was 2021, having his Humanist of the Year award rescinded by the American Humanist Association because of his take on that. So all of this stuff was going on. I was watching from the sidelines.
So all of this throughout this whole period, you're doing your unbelievable broadcasts.
Yeah, exactly. And
bringing together Christians
occasionally,
and
bringing guests on to comment on some of these latest controversies. And it did, exactly as you said, I think it was symptomatic of the fact that the movement didn't have anything coherent to actually bring it together long term. And there is that question of what do you replace God with? Where do the moral foundations for anything come from? Because it turns out there's a lot of different ideas out there about what direction we should go in. And so as that movement started to sort of lose steam, I noticed just a lot of other interesting secular intellectuals often, but who were not dismissing Christianity, who were coming out of the woodwork. The most obvious example being Jordan Peterson. Around 2018, I brought him on my show opposite an atheist psychologist, Susan Blackmore. And it was just fascinating because he was just sort of starting to have this extraordinary ascent into public consciousness. And here was a person who wasn't exactly a Christian by most measures, but who was defending really just the fact that you need something like the idea that humans are made in the image of God to make sense of life.
I mean, it seems, one of Jordan's really important, one of the messages to which I think he's brought really more importantly into the public space is this idea that in fact facts on their own are not really enough to provide any sort of a guide to how to live, then in fact we need stories as well.
Absolutely.
And I mean, he's always sort of stayed on the fence about the truth claims of any of those stories, or in what sense we can say that they're true, or in what dimension we can speak of them as true. But he's made a remarkably powerful case and a very impactful one for the necessity of stories. And then also people will listen entranced for 2 hours as he expounds the story
and
of Noah.
I think one of his helpful points he makes as well as sort of pointing people back to the stories you find in scripture and the way they obviously undergird so many of our basic assumptions about life in the West. He's also said, frequently and did on this occasion, that it's the things you do that actually betray what you really believe deep down, not the things you say
That's right.
you believe. And his sort of challenge, which he didn't take very lightly to Susan Blackmore was, you say you're an atheist, but I don't think you live like you're an atheist. I don't think you the way in which you conduct your life doesn't suggest to me that we're living in a sort of ultimately a nihilistic void. And I think there's something to that. I think, deep down, our actual actions betray what we really believe about life.
Yeah, very, very few people, I think, seem as though they did their best to live their atheistic faith or lack of faith.
There's probably a few people who have managed it, but
possibly the closest was Nietzsche. And
yeah,
I mean,
he didn't come to
his ending was not an especially happy one.
He was, if you like, the atheist who grasped the nettle, but it's not a pleasant nettle to grasp. I think, one of the points that Peterson and then many others in his wake, like Tom Holland, the historian, and others have been making in recent years, is simply that the reality is the new atheists were all very Christian, actually, in terms of their fundamental assumptions. And they
as are the humanists on the whole.
As are the humanists, the British humanists. It's just a huge blind spot that, as it happens, all of your moral beliefs about equality, dignity, value, freedom, compassion, consent, and so on, just so happen to tally very nicely with all the values that Christendom gave us. And they didn't come out of a vacuum. They didn't come out of the Enlightenment or science or atheism. And I think more and more, as we've started to see some of those values being pushed back on in contemporary culture, more and more people are actually sort of saying, it turns out, maybe Christianity did give us a few things that were somewhat worthwhile. And what do we do in the absence of that story? Because it feels like the atheist, naturalist, materialist story of reality isn't inspiring people to go in that direction, isn't inspiring great works of art, literature, humanity, compassion, the flourishing of culture. So what do we do? Have we rejected the story, or do we need to bring it back in some sense?
I think I don't know if Tom Holland is explicitly making the case that people should go to church, but he's the end point of his remarkable book Dominion is really to draw out just how much of the water that we swim in, the air that we breathe is based in this Christian is still saturated.
Absolutely.
With Christian moral framework. So I'm curious, Justin, how did you come to spend 20 years hosting Unbelievable? What got you to the point where you started doing that? What's good? Because you must have some considerable skin in the game to commit that much of your professional life to it.
Well, I am a Christian, and I suppose I became, I was raised in a Christian family, but faith became my own really in my sort of late teens. But I think at the point where I started to really encounter skepticism, doubt, and so on, university and thereafter, I started to just engage in what is often called Christian apologetics, so rational defense of the faith, started reading authors like Chesterton and C.S. Lewis and others. And that was all very helpful and helped to, for my, if you like, intellectual life to catch up with the sort of experiential side of what I felt I had when it came to Christian faith. But I've always had an interest in dramatics, theatre, presentation. So I was looking for something I could do once university was over that might help to, bring all these interests together. And so I ended up in radio, specifically on a Christian radio station in London, which is a somewhat unusual phenomenon, but there is one. And a few years in, I went to the CEO and said, I'd really love to create conversations between Christians and non-Christians because unlike the US where, you can still sort of live in a Christian bubble almost. In the UK, if you are a Christian, it's somewhat unusual and you're much more likely to be rubbing shoulders in your family and your friends and your neighborhood with people who don't share your faith. So I said, it's lovely that we can sort of broadcast things that are helpful and encouraging for Christians who are listening, but what if we actually broadcast a real conversation between a Christian and a skeptic that would help them to actually navigate those conversations themselves? And so this idea of a show called Unbelievable was born, initially just a radio show, but where I would be joined each week by a Christian and a non-Christian, moderate a discussion between them, but turned into a podcast. We were sort of quite early adopters of the podcasting thing. And that's when it really actually took off, actually, because that's when a lot of not just Christians, but non-Christians started to pick it up. So every time I would have a fairly well-known atheist of some kind on, they might then go and post it on their blog or in time social media. And suddenly I'd find I was, getting emails from all kinds of interesting skeptics from all over the world saying I really enjoyed that conversation and so on. So I was in the privileged position eventually for many years of sort of, being in the middle of these conversations with a very diverse audience, actually, across the faith spectrum. And that was wonderful because it felt like a real privilege and a gift to be able to shepherd those conversations. And I tried not to, in that sense, I was always glad when I received feedback from non-Christian listeners who said, it took me a few shows listening to realize you were a Christian, Justin, because I was trying to be somewhat neutral in the way I handled those, just letting the arguments speak for themselves on either side. And I think, in the end, if Christianity is true, then it should be able to stand up on its own two feet intellectually. Not that we have all the answers, not that there aren't many mysteries, lots of things that I still, categorize under, maybe we'll find out on the other side of eternity. But I did realize, as I said, in the nearly 20 years hosting that show, that actually, when you put it side by side with all the other possible worldviews out there, be it atheist materialism or Islam or something else, Christianity is actually quite a compelling account of reality. For all its the questions it still leaves you with, it seems to have this resonance and a kind of historical integrity that that for me makes it sort of makes sense to believe in that sense.
I struggle to think of a more compassionate balance between a tragic account of human nature and a sense that it might not all be doom and gloom.
Absolutely. You know, yeah.
Even if we have to sit tight for now.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you talk about podcasts and really the impact that shifting from radio to podcasts had on expanding your reach and broadening the audience and getting a different level and kind of engagement, I find that really interesting because it picks up on a point that I wanted to ask you about. You know, because you've documented the early stages and then this real acceleration of a return to Christian faith, and really I think a return to religious engagement more generally, but particularly Christianity. And I've noticed it as well. I mean, it's impossible to imagine, as I said, that some watching a conversation in New York in front on an enormous screen and in front of an audience of paying listeners between Richard Dawkins and one of his former new atheist friends, where she describes her conversion. That's simply astonishing, you know, and not something I could have imagined 20 years ago. Something has changed. And one of the things I wonder about is to what extent that has been. You mentioned the sense of nihilism and the sense of despair, and in the book you talk about the meaning crisis and the sense people have of just being so lonely and so atomized and so absorbed in our little glowing screens and just desperately lonely and in need of a story and actually I think of coming together, you know, Sunday worship, you know, the evidence is in very, very robustly on the health-giving, life-giving, joy-giving, community-building power of regular worship, as you very eloquently set out in the book. So all of those things are true and real, and the glowing screen is a vector for that kind of atomization. Yeah. But I've been extremely online since the early aughts, and I think I'm going to put this to you. One of my working hypotheses is that yes, it's a vector for atomization, but I also think it's a vector for exactly the religious revival which you're documenting. Yeah. And there's this really paradoxical quality of the internet in that sense. I mean, it really is a two-edged sword. I mean, we can talk about that more, but I think it's making things worse and it's also making things more religious again.
Yes.
What do you think?
I entirely agree. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. Because the reality is that the way in which now people consume media, because it's changed so dramatically in the past 20 years, means that those traditional gatekeepers of only a few, you know, particular media outlets, the BBC, ITV in the UK, or, you know, particular broadsheets, kind of basically being the funnel through which ideas can be, consumed, that's completely changed. And now it's so easy to track down any kind of ideology, interest, thought. And it has just opened this door for people who have a talent for, you know, communicating the faith, whether it be Islam, Christianity or something else. They will find an audience. And so my show, in a sense, was in the early stages of that, you know, picked up on the growing organic growth of podcasting. It's now sort of a whole different league. Now you've got YouTube channels with millions of subscribers and everything else. But it has opened up the possibility of people just bumping into, you know, arguments that they weren't being exposed to before when it came to faith or culture or anything else. And that is a good thing. Obviously, it also runs the danger of a lot of misinformation being out there. And this was the interesting thing about the New Atheist movement. They were very early adopters of those, you know, early forms of video, podcasts and so on. And so they were able to actually get a lot of stuff out that was frankly pretty poor scholarship around Jesus never existed and this sorts of stuff. So obviously, it's a two-edged sword, as you say, but it's been interesting to say the way that there has been a sort of extraordinary revival almost happening through the media channels. And like you say, it goes hand in hand with this meaning crisis that's been turbocharged by the digital revolution. But it's almost as though, I often look at it, Mary, as though, you know, people almost have to be brought face to face with the fact that the more science, the more technology we put in, the more we realize these things are not going to save us. They tend to only exacerbate our worst traits rather than, you know, help us to become the flourishing humans that we somehow feel we have the capacity to be. And I think because people are reaching that boundary point of thinking, this isn't working, modern culture isn't working, that the story of atheist materialism that sort of has undergirded so much of modern Western culture just isn't actually delivering on its promises. And that's where you get an Ayaan Hirsi Ali from, I think, because she kind of came face to face with that at a personal level. And she said, this story isn't feeding me any longer. And it just opened her up to the possibility of God. And then when she sort of stepped into that, suddenly the lights came on. And I just sense, yeah, more and more people going on a similarish journey to that.
Yeah, I mean, you could almost make the case that there's something about the new atheist worldview, which has a very end of history quality to it. You know, in a sense, it's of a piece with the idea. I mean, I grew up in the 1990s, and I can remember very clearly feeling as though the just sort of like that was sort of it.
Yep.
You know, in a very flat way. You know, from here on in, it was just going to be more shopping and more, you know, fairly kind of flat, unremarkable. You know, there weren't going to be any more big wars. There wasn't going to be any more big anything really. And now we laugh looking back. My gosh, but it really did feel like that.
Yeah.
And it really felt as though there weren't really any, you know, it wasn't even meaningfully possible to dispute capitalism, even if you were a sort of foamingly leftist teenager, as I inevitably I was. This sort of end of history flatness, it felt as though the sort of telos, the final telos that we'd arrived at, actually was just shopping malls.
Absolutely. And I think there was a sort of complacency almost among the humanists, you know, for want of a better word, that were swimming around in the 90s to say, well, it's basically sorted now. Mm. You know, it's shown that we don't need religion. It's sort of tailing off, and we're sort of heading off into this
and perhaps future. And I mean, you know, much as 9/11 was the end of the end of was the beginning of the end of history. The beginning of the end of the end,
end of
history.
The end of history. Yeah, I know what you mean.
You know, because that was, you don't really need any more visceral proof positive that, no, actually, there really are some very, very extreme religious believers out here, even if they're not Christian. Mm. And they have a very different worldview to us. That was a profoundly, utterly sort of world-shattering event for...
And I think generally the rise of Islam in the West has been a kind of reminder that there are alternative stories of reality that obviously attract and are incredibly influential to whole swathes of
people.
That's
right. And then the global financial crash, which I feel sort of bookended the end of history. Mm. You know, it began with 9/11 and then it finished with the global financial crash, which actually, interestingly, is roughly concurrent with the point where the first iPhone landed.
Mm.
And it feels, I mean, reality started going weird with 9/11.
Yeah.
And then it really started going weird with the financial crash and the iPhone. And since then, everybody's just gone down this rabbit hole. And now, you know, some years later, here we are in a really very strange and different place.
It is. And so I think that this meaning crisis, as it's been called, has been percolating for, you know, a couple hundred years, really. But it's sort of reached this zenith.
Of curiosity, where do you date the beginning of the meaning crisis?
Well, probably... You know, somewhere around the Enlightenment, the sense that we lost
Descartes or later.
Descartes, I think, is probably a pretty good point at which, if you like, reason started to kind of take the place of a natural sense of
that's the beginning of the mechanistic universe,
exactly,
as well, isn't it? The point where the cogito separates from
absolutely
the world out there,
where we become the subject rather than God, and to that extent, you know. From that point onwards, I think you start to see this drift towards essentially the separation of religion from, as it were, real life, and the privatization of religion rather than it being just an assumed part of the fabric of reality. And to that extent, we lost, you know, to go back to your story metaphor, we started to replace the story of God and Christianity, which is obviously for, you know, 1500 years essentially given us our sense of who we are. It started to be replaced with a different story, or a non-story, really, which is that we are essentially a cog in an otherwise meaningless clockwork universe. And this was, and this sort of, you know, percolated and became the baseline hum, I think, in our culture, kind of assumption, certainly in the academy and in lots of other ways. But I think it's only once that's kind of locked in to this incredibly materialistic, tech-driven culture that tends to exacerbate all our worst, aspects as humans, that you suddenly get this this crunch point that I think we've hit with social media and the kind of, you know, the postmodern thing of, well, if there isn't any story that we're essentially part of, we can just do whatever we like. We can make it up as we go along. We can be whoever we want. We can, you know, as long as I'm not hurting anyone else, though that's sort of interestingly tied still to a kind of religious Christian undercurrent. But it's this sort of, we've reached this culture where everybody is so confused, distracted, and ultimately depressed that they kind of reach a point of just not being able to get anything done anymore in any creative way. And they look back at previous generations and wonder, how did they do all the things that they managed to do? We've got all these resources, technology in front of us, and yet we seem to be making ourselves more and more unhappy now. And so I think this is the catalyst for what I see as this return to people saying, well, maybe we need to look back at this original story, this Christian faith. It's why, you know, some of those people I mentioned earlier, Tom Holland and Peterson and Ian Hirst-Yalley, have been sort of leading at a sort of intellectual, cultural level, a kind of giving intellectual permission for people to look at the story again. And it's been extraordinary to see. I suppose I started to notice it in the sort of end of the 2010s, around 2018, 2019. I just noticed more and more people being willing to give Christianity a second look because they were feeling like what was on offer in secular culture wasn't working. And then you fast forward to when I actually published the book in 2023, and I was sort of making this case that the new atheist era was basically dead. There was this new conversation on God happening in the culture. But I didn't have any statistical evidence that much was changing. You know, all of the statistics still showed church decline, rise in irreligiosity, and so on. But then just after the book was published, Ian Hirst-Yalley had her conversion moment. And I thought, gosh, her story is almost a perfect encapsulation of my general thesis here. And then the following year and since, all this interesting data started to come out about what people are often now calling a quiet revival, that especially among the younger generation, who I think are suffering most at the sharp end of this meaning crisis, there's this sudden new interest in faith. Completely unexpected, because everyone assumed young people, especially young men, who are the demographic that seems most likely to be re-engaging with faith, everyone assumed they were gone forever from the pews of church. And yet, according to some of this data that's coming out, they're saying, actually, we're quite interested in coming back. And so I find that really interesting. I wasn't expecting, you know, when I proposed my thesis in the book, I thought, well, if there's anything going to happen, it might be 10, 20, 30 years hence. I wasn't expecting something to happen within the next 2 years that seemed to somewhat confirm that.
Picking up on two themes in everything. I mean, this tracks very much with my observations as well, though obviously this is something you've been tracking very much more closely. And there are two phenomena which I've found interesting there. One is that there seems to be... We should talk about denominations because yes, there's definitely a quiet revival, but it's not evenly distributed, is it? And I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about some of the more granular information.
Well,
where are people going?
Even before that, the data that we call the quiet revival was published last year, I remember doing an event with you, Mary, where you talked about the fact that there was this sort of PowerPoint wielding sort of technocratic kind of version of the C of E, which was not going to see this kind of revival because it's just so unappealing to people. And I think there is a sort of mushy middle in the church, which is so sadly captured.
I'm very allergic to PowerPoint in churches.
Exactly.
I may not be the only one, but it's certainly something that I feel very strongly about.
It's interesting because this is exactly what the data, what you said was exactly reflected actually in the data that came out, because it turns out that the people who do seem to be coming back to church, they're opting for either something very traditional, liturgical, smells and bells,
the
high church.
Bros.
Yeah, the ortho bros. So people who want the kind of high Anglican or Catholic or even Eastern Orthodox, that's where a lot of the growth seems to be, and especially among young people, interestingly. Or the other end of that spectrum is the more Pentecostal, charismatic variety of church, you know, open to, you know, the signs of the spirit, speaking in tongues, you know, ecstatic experiences and so on. And it's the churches that are somewhere in the middle that are still sort of just arguably somewhat aping the culture and so on that seem to be less appealing. And And one way of putting this, and the way, you know, Tom Holland has put it, is he said it's weird Christianity that's actually attractive. And it, you know, he says, if you're looking to attract people like me, Justin, back to church, keep Christianity weird, because we're not just looking for a warmed over version with a bit of spiritual topping of what's already on offer in the culture. If we're coming to church, we're coming because we want to experience something different to that. And so I think people are very attracted, interestingly, to the aesthetic and the historical depth and the sense that you're stepping into something deep and meaningful in those more traditional liturgical forms, or equally the weirdness of the charismatic and, you know, ecstatic experience. There's something that's different about that. And so I think that's partly because people are looking for a better story. They're looking for something that feels quite different in church.
And there is unmistakably a sense in which the internet is serving to recruit. But there are obviously some tensions there, because I remember seeing, ironically or perhaps not, on the internet that Pope Leo, the relatively recent new head of the Roman Catholic Church, spoke explicitly to the way people are coming to Catholic faith through the internet, and warned that it's possible to be, he was basically warning against very online Christianity without the embodied component.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that he's possibly out in front of some areas of some people in thinking explicitly about the relationship between technology and faith in that way.
I think so. And this is a great danger. I think because we now, so much of what we do is mediated by screens and technology, it's possible for people to assume that I can be a Christian or engage in this by essentially just consuming.
What did you make of the COVID era and the churches, the sort of mainstream churches response?
I think I understand those who were very saddened or disappointed by the fact that the churches effectively closed their doors and followed all the advice. Now, I think I also have a lot of sympathy for church leaders who were trying to do their best under difficult circumstances, you know, in what was somewhat exceptional case. But I think ultimately, you know, I do think it was a shame in a sense that the one place where hopefully at that moment of existential crisis that essentially COVID represented for most people, it was not easy to access the people who are meant to be there to provide spiritual support. So I think churches should have been a little bit more proactive in trying to do everything they can to enable some form of community and that sort of thing. And certainly I think some of the measures in the Anglican Church seemed far too draconian when it came to simply, you know, even banning priests from walking into their own church just to celebrate Mass, you know, for people online. It seemed sort of somewhat bizarre, but it was a strange time. What I will say of COVID is, you know, in my experience, it was also a time in which, because it forced this sort of break from the normal business of reality, I met so many people for whom they sort of had some kind of spiritual journey during COVID, and it forced them to think about their own mortality as much as anything else. What am I here for? What's the point? And I do feel like COVID, in that sense, there's a sort of pre-COVID culture and a post-COVID culture. And whatever you make of the, you know, the political aspects of COVID and the vaccines and everything else, there was also a sense that after COVID and after the lockdowns, I think that is part of the reason why we're seeing this return to faith, because it represented a kind of realization for so many people that we're not very good at sorting ourselves out with technology, politics, or anything else. It feels like all of those things have been in turmoil ever since. And, you know, Trump, for better or worse, has kind of been an interesting example of this, that culture is going off in all kinds of interesting and crazy directions. And a lot of people, I think, have come to the conclusion, you know what? Technology, science, politics, they're running out of control, and we're not going to solve our problems. So let's try something else, as I said. And COVID felt like that lockdown period felt like a kind of fire break that allowed people to start exploring.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's certainly true for me. I remember having a very visceral reaction during COVID, particularly in relation to the Christian church, to the idea of celebrating the Eucharist remotely. Mm. I remember feeling viscerally that there was something fundamentally wrongheaded about that. Mm. You know, but I'd never really thought through in any. Yeah. I'd never thought all the way through the argument about the incarnational nature of Christian faith, about the incarnation being the centre of the story, and you know that the role that the Eucharist plays in celebrating that. You know, as a physical embodied thing that involves, you know, the physical consuming of the consecrated host. That was just not something I'd ever really thought through concretely before. And I think in that sense, what you say about how the way COVID and the sincere, well-meaning, I hope well-meaning, effort to force things online that really oughtn't to be online, confronted people, at least confronted some people with the question of what in fact we can't digitize.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, are there some things that we can't digitize? If so, why?
Yeah.
And there are obvious things like the education of small children, which is, are you mad?
Yeah.
Schools absolutely. Are living with the consequences of that mistake.
I think that's absolutely right. And we know.
But then
that
there are these subtler things as well, like the Eucharist.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a theological person. I'm not, you know. I was raised sort of ambivalently heretical Anglican. I was surprised to find myself have such a strong reaction to that and to the sort of, and to find myself forced to think through that.
It's been proven beyond a doubt that enforced time of social isolation that COVID represented was incredibly bad for our mental health. Now, it may have done something potentially to help the physical health of the COVID. That's obviously up for debate. But I think we're actually reaping all kinds of negative consequences of that enforced isolation. And what was interesting was there was just a huge sigh of relief once churches could essentially start meeting together again, because it was like what we've been doing up to in this interim period isn't really church, and it's not really what we're designed for. Church has to be embodied. It has to be about rubbing along with other physical human beings. And to the extent that technology now is rampantly continuing to break down that natural embodied community through AI especially, which now offers, you know, you companionship through a digital avatar, or, you know, an AI girlfriend or whatever, we're quickly turning into a culture where we're making it possible to live completely independently of other human beings. And for me, that is a disaster for us. It's going to have all kinds of incredibly bad repercussions.
I mean, if you're a parent, it's self-evidently a disaster.
Yeah. Absolutely. Exactly.
I never want to see a depressed 3-year-old again.
Yeah,
that's just...
I know. And so church is fast becoming, you know, just the thing that you normally do in church, which is get together, worship together, pray together, sing together, celebrate communion together, and then probably have a cup of tea or coffee afterwards. It's relatively simple. It's not, you know, it's not some grand, you know, all singing, all dancing evangelistic strategy, but it turns out it's one of the most important things you can do in life. And Christians have been doing it for centuries, and hopefully will continue to be doing it. And the church is one of the last places where I think you can still find regular embodied human community. And for me, that's one of the great strengths of church going forward in this increasingly isolated, digitized age. The church simply has at its disposal something which is absolutely central to human flourishing, and we need to lean into that.
I think that's absolutely right. So I wonder if you, I mean, Keep Christianity Weird is a great starting point, but I wonder if you have a sense of the prognosis for mainstream Anglicanism in this country. Mm. I mean, this is, you know, we were talking about, well, when did the meaning crisis start? And it's, I don't know, I'm sort of, you know, as an averagely heretical Anglican, I feel like I'm on perilous brand here. But it feels to me as though the nationalization of faith in Britain worked well for a while. But I've wondered in public before whether that's reaching a point now of increasing tension, you know, partly because of the direction of travel of mainstream politics. Mm. I mean, I'm thinking particularly here about recent passage through Parliament of legislation decriminalising abortion all the way up to term, which, I mean, you know, the Anglicans are not as hardline as, they're not as sort of unambiguous as the Roman Catholic Church, for example, on abortion. But, you know, this, it's, you know, the... the Bishop of London, I think, and a number of others have been very clear about, you know, decriminalising abortion up to term is that's not cool. You can't do that. And even more unambiguously, the assisted dying, the medically assisted suicide. Legislation is difficult to see how you can reconcile that with Christian doctrine and remain a Christian church. Given that, I've been scratching my head at how you navigate that as an established church, and wondering if there's a point at which either the tenor of mainstream politics changes or the relationship between politics and the Anglican Church is going to have to. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the Church has always been navigating, you know, that tension between what's going on at a national level in terms of political and so on. If you go back to Maggie Thatcher in the 80s, you know, she had her run-ins with the church leaders who disagreed with some of her policies. I think there's always going to be those tensions. I think I'm glad to have seen, you know, some pushback from the Anglican Church and especially the Catholic Church to those issues when they were running through Parliament, because I think the church does have to have a sort of, to some extent, a prophetic voice speaking to, you know, truth to power in that sense. I think that the great danger is also when the church sort of just becomes a mouthpiece, sadly, also just for the latest fashionable kind of orthodoxies in politics and that kind of thing. And that can make it just feel like a sort of a bit of a wet rag, sort of just, you know, aping whatever so on. So it's a really difficult thing. I mean, if I'm honest, you know, you look at the state of the Church of England at a national level, it's been a bit of a disaster for the last few years, with the comings and goings of Welby and then Mullally coming in, all of the scandalous stuff around abuse scandals and everything else. And at that level, you could say it's all a bit of a shambles, and you might be somewhat right. What gives me hope is actually when I go at the local level, I see a lot of good things happening in local churches, and a lot of those Anglican ministers sort of rolling their eyes at what's happening at a national level, but saying, actually, we're seeing a lot of new people come in here, and we're seeing some really positive, you know, initiatives birthing here. So even in, you know, the Anglican Church, which has for decades had just headlines about decreasing numbers and, you know, falling off a cliff and all that. Obviously, COVID was massive and it sort of decimated church going for a year or two. But it's interesting that since COVID, numbers have been ticking up year on year. Now, in a sense, that might just be recovery after the sort of the COVID low. But I don't think it's just that. I mean, you look at the last two Easters and Christmases that we've just had, unprecedented numbers of people turning up for Christmas and Easter services. And I just sense that it's part of this bigger picture of people looking for something. Now, whether they will find a permanent home, whether they will be disappointed inevitably with the church because it doesn't get things right on a national level, and it often does, you know, duck some of the important issues it probably should be talking about, remains to be seen. But I do sense that in most cases, actually, while people sort of often get turned off by the institutional national church, when it comes to their local church, they can see all the good things it's doing, and they're kind of more willing to turn up there and sort of and dissociate the local incarnation from the national church. I don't know what the future of the Church of England is on a national scale. I think probably it will end up splitting because of the internal fractures that are there.
I mean, I know there have been some tensions recently over the most recent choice of Archbishop, which
is absolutely
the worldwide Anglican communion is not in a happy place at the moment.
No, it's not. And essentially, you've got already in practice a split between the so-called what's called GAFCON, you know, group of confessing Anglicans who represent essentially many parts of the Anglican Church and diocese across the global South. And is essentially half of the Anglican Church in the world. And so there is already the Anglican Church has been split in half for quite a while already. I think the figurehead now being Sarah Mullally has just sort of intensified the fact that this is probably going to come apart officially fairly soon.
Picking up on the theme of national church revival and really of men as well, another interesting and curious tension that I've picked up on recently, and which I find really, I wondered what you thought about. So I read a really fascinating article recently by a young journalist called Fred Sculthorpe, who's superb on he does sort of travelogue pieces and observed pieces, and he'll sort of document his observations of contemporary Britain. And he went along to one of the rallies organised by Tommy Robinson, who's a far right activist, for anybody who's not come across him, a British far right activist who's particularly exercised against Islam, and who's had a number of stints in prison. During one of those stints in prison, I believe he was converted to Christianity by a charismatic pastor whose name escapes me just now, but who has since organized at least one rally on an explicitly Christian theme, bringing together really young, mostly men, probably more men than not, thematically Christian, thematically, but also culturally with a strong undertone, or even, you know, a fairly explicit central message of nativism, of I don't want to say cultural chauvinism, and this has prompted some strong reactions from within the existing English Christian community, which I think it's probably fair to say generally dresses to the somewhat to the left, and who are appalled by the idea of believing Christians who are also perhaps a little bit on the nativist side.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if you had any
it's
read
interesting.
On that.
I do. And in a sense, it's become a big theme of my work. So the book that was published a few years ago sort of was tracing this kind of interesting conversation changing, you know, at a cultural level around God. And then a podcast series that's followed it. It's a documentary podcast series of the same name, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, has sort of traced what that's looked like right up to the present. And one of the things that's become most obvious is that just as much as there's a religious vibe shift, there's a political vibe shift, and the two are very much connected. And so, yes, I think that you've got, on the one hand, if you like, this spiritual meaning crisis that's led people to start to reinvestigate faith. But you've also got this sense that culture is going off course in all kinds of ways, and people kind of looking towards Christianity in particular as a way of restoring some kind of story to civic life and so on. And so you've got the rise of, you know, for want of a better word, Christian nationalism, alongside a kind of, you know, people who just sort of want to re-engage Christian faith. And that's where you get people like Tommy Robinson, I think. And arguably the reason Tommy Robinson has been so appealing to so many people and with his recent turn to faith, has sort of grasped onto Christianity as being a central part of the identity of being British and so on. I think that speaks to the fact that sadly many parts of the church have not given an adequate sort of story and a sense of identity and so on. Mm-hmm. And it has been too much kind of a sense of, I don't know, just a very watered down version of liberal humanism that's sort of on offer.
I mean, there's a sense in which isn't there, like, that this is a sort of deep trauma response to the two world wars.
Yeah.
I mean, I've sort of read a little bit over the contemporary religious responses to the two world wars and the utter horror of believing Christians, for example, to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah. And Ronald Knox wrote a very moving book about that, Science and Faith and Violence and War. But there are a lot of ordinary people as well who went through the two world wars and survived fighting in the two world wars and just lost their faith, particularly after the First World War, because that really was cheered on all sides by the respective religious leaders of the nations of the main belligerents. And I think there are a lot of people, you know, who were told, you know, this is the Christian thing to do. You must fight for your country. And it was very much indexed to faith. And then, you know, following that catastrophe, which I think we're still living in the ruins of in Europe, there were a lot of people who, I mean, there was a deep recoil by Christian religious leaders from ever wanting to be complicit in something like that again.
Yes, in terms of kind of allying Christianity to some kind of nationalistic sort of movement.
So again, there's a sort of deep, well-meaning, you know, desire to avoid another kind
there is,
of
there is,
disaster.
But here we are. And yet the problem is that we do exist in a culture which is looking for a story to make sense of itself. Mm-hmm. And now, so I'm, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Tony Robinson, you know, to be clear. But what I do sense is the reason he is appealing to so many people is because the church, as I say, hasn't really done a very good job in actually reaching those people. And Tommy Robinson is able to reach and speak to the average working class person, people who feel that they've been left behind by the, you know, metropolitan elites, and that their concerns are not being looked after. And actually, there is a deep resonance when he says, actually, there is a story that undergirds this island and that makes you. Now, the problem, of course, is that there are going to be people who are going to then use that essentially in the service of a sort of political mm-hmm. ideology. And for me, if Christianity is true, if the gospel is true, it has to at some level transcend mm-hmm. sort of categories of left and right mm-hmm. and so on. It's not that you can't be political and be a Christian, but if the Christianity is kind of essentially being used to drive a political agenda, yep. That's yep. that's a problem.
It's fascinating watching yeah. the American public discourse try and make sense of the Pope.
Absolutely.
I mean, being a case yeah. in point, one moment he'll say something, they'll all say, based! And the next moment he'll say, the next sentence, they'll all say, cringe!
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's a complete whiplash all of the time.
It is. And the problem is, because we live in such a highly politicised social media culture now, it's kind of like everyone just filters everything through that. Mm. And so it's impossible to please people yeah. in that sense. Yeah. So it's a really difficult position. What's interesting is, you had back in the summer of 2025, the Unite the Kingdom rally led by Robinson. And that was the point at which a lot of people noticed there's a lot of Christian imagery here mm-hmm. Alongside, obviously, the political stuff and people chanting, Christ is King and everything else. And so that caused a lot of consternation, understandably. Is this the rise of quote-unquote Christian nationalism? Then there was
you could also make the case that the being an established church is itself,
we have a national church.
How is that not Christian or national Christianity, Christian nationalism? Yeah, what's the difference?
This is the problem. The phrase Christian nationalism can encompass a whole range of things, from a very soft version to something quite hard. Mm.
The Christian nationalism as a boo word makes sense from an American point of view, where the founding principles was always freedom of religion, and trying to get away from the being an established church. But from a British point of view, the idea of it being a boo word is sort of confusing.
I know, it's a strange thing because we've never had a kind of separation of church and state. But there's always been, I think, a kind of a basic assumption in the UK that we're trying to create an umbrella for lots of people of different perspectives to flourish. And that, that's the way I think, when Danny Kruger did that viral sort of speech in Parliament to an empty Parliament, really, about what we lose when we lose Christian faith as an undergirding principle in the UK. He said, the Anglican Church at its best has been a sort of an umbrella for lots of perspectives to flourish. But the problem is, when you lose that umbrella, when you lose the distinctive Christianness of a country, something else will replace it. And that's the fear, that's come up. And that's what you're seeing, I think, in these marches and so on. Then, of course, interestingly, Tommy Robinson puts on this carol service just before Christmas.
That's the one you're thinking of, I think.
And again, it was interesting because initially some of the emails circulated by Robinson himself seemed to be pushing it as a kind of middle finger to Sadiq Khan, sort of, we're going to, and a kind of politicized edge to this. But then the official sort of stuff around it said, no, this is not a political event. It's not an anti-Islam event. It's, we're just here to celebrate and put Christ back into Christmas. And so I was speaking to a lot of church leaders who were deeply concerned about this thing. Mm-hmm. Now, as it turned out, it was a fairly benign affair. And it was just people singing carols. And it was actually quite diverse.
My charitable read of it is that actually the English really love singing. that it really is as simple as that. I mean, if you think about how deep the English choral tradition goes, I mean, I argue that one of the most living, the two most living remnants of the English choral tradition are one, churchgoers, and two, English football stands. Mm. And both of those are just as lively, slightly different registers, but they're instances of the English choral tradition. And if Tommy Robinson, anybody who's getting people together to sing in England is doing a good thing.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I don't know where Tommy Robinson is on this faith journey. It was very interesting, though, to hear him share just at the very end of this carol service something of his own spiritual journey, his sense that he always felt the church was against him, but that since having this conversion experience in prison, he felt actually that something new was happening. And now, the problem is, I'm perfectly happy to take that at face value. The question for me is, Christianity has to transform us, obviously, from the inside out. And it can't just sort of give a new label for us to continue doing what we were doing. And so we'll see how that develops. And I don't want to prejudge that. But it's a mixed bag, basically, Mary. There's all sorts of things happening at the same time. There's pure motives and very mixed motives when it comes to why people want to see Christianity back. My sense is, you know, and I speak here as a Christian, that there is a God, and Christianity, and the gates of hell will not prevail over the church. Okay. But what that looks like in the messy tangle of human history, we will probably only really be able to tell 50, 100 years hence. I often use the parable of the wheat and the tares. Okay. When people say, isn't this revival you're talking about, this surprising rebirth, just a political thing, Justin? I say, well, look, Jesus gave this parable about a farmer who went out to sow his field, but in the night an enemy came and sowed weeds among it. And when the servants saw the wheat and the tares growing up together, they said, do you want to just go in and rip up these tares? He said, no, don't do that, because you might rip up the good wheat as well. Wait till it's all grown up together, and then we'll sort it out in the final harvest. We'll chuck out the good, the bad, you know, keep the good. And I think there's a sense in which I want to say, like, don't dismiss this just because there's wheat and tares growing up together. There seems to be mixed motives and pure motives together. Something's happening. There's a harvest. And maybe we need to let God be the judge in the end of what the fruit of this is going to be. And he can be the one who actually deciphers the reality of the human heart and who was really doing this for the pure and good motives and who wasn't. The reality is, I don't know anyone who's come to faith from entirely pure motives. That's the point of grace. You know, if people are coming to faith through a Tommy Robinson activism, God draw straight with crooked lines. You know, I'm not here to prejudge how people eventually come to faith. And so we kind of have to wait and allow and let God be God, I think.
Wise words, I think. And a beautiful note to end on. Justin, thank you so much for coming. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you and hear your accumulated wisdom of this transformation, which seems to be afoot across the world in what could otherwise be a lonely and frightening moment. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for hosting me. It's been a pleasure to be on.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.